Welcome back to Luxury News Weekly. Today we're going to be talking about how Bottega Veneta is taking over the Great Wall of China, why Hermès hates NFTs, the unfortunate death of Terry Mugler, and the $1.7 million Porsche Daniel Mack wishes he spotted, and last but not least, the $125 million mushroom leather empire that was used by Hermès. So let's get into it with the Bottega Veneta.
Welcome to Luxury News Weekly, your number one source for luxury news. I'm your host, Simba Wakatama.
And I'm your host, Elizabeth Solaru.
Right, so Bottega Veneta had a very big campaign, and it was, how would you put it? Well, a historical, monumental campaign, because they took a section of the Great Wall of China and put down what seems to be a gigantic carpet, which says Bottega Veneta in their iconic green. And then in Chinese calligraphy, on an orange carpet, they put Happy New Year. So this is obviously a campaign. Now, I must mention, they are paying to repair that section of the Great Wall of China because, of course, it needs a lot of maintenance. It's a gigantic wall. It's very long. And, of course, it's of historical importance. So they are paying for that. But they're also doing an ad on it. So what's your take on this, Elizabeth?
Well, this I was absolutely shocked by because this is an historical monument. And my initial reaction was that it was tacky, it was insensitive, and it's just a cheap way to try and sell leather goods in China. Because I don't know if many people know this, around the Chinese New Year, tradition is that you get a new wardrobe, essentially. And that is why a number of designer labels are beating a path to China and to try to attract Chinese clients by obviously inducing them to buy new wardrobe or new dresses or, you know, new things to celebrate the Chinese New Year. This to me, it's not exactly, I don't want to use the word desecration of a historical monument, but that's how I feel about it. And yes, I do accept and understand that they are paying to repair a part of the wall. Great. But the quid pro quo for me, it doesn't sit well. So I think it's kind of very tacky, very insensitive, and they could have done other things rather than do that. But to be fair, it has achieved what they wanted to achieve in that people are talking about it. And Bottega, they've also been in the news recently for the departure of their creative director. So I don't know if this campaign was put together before he departed. I should imagine so, because these campaigns take time, or if it was something that was decided by the new creative director.
Very good points there. Yeah, I would assume so. I would assume it was done when he was still around. Of course, there are reasons he left, or maybe was kicked out. Who knows? We'll save that for another episode. But I do want to also mention that in this particular case, to give you some background as to why Bottega Veneta might do something like that. Of course, like you said, Elizabeth, the new year, it's a big spending time. It's Chinese tradition to get money during the new year, right? You give, you'll give money to children.
That's correct. Right? In red envelopes, right?
Yep. So if you're the uncle, you're the aunt, you're giving to your nieces, your nephews, and some of them aren't even children, right? They'll be in their 20s or what have you. I've even received a red envelope before, you know, so it's great. You get money or gold. It's great. But Bottega Veneta, they went off all social media.
Oh, yes, they did that a while back. It was another stunt, wasn't it?
It was. So now they're trying to get earned media through it would seem, word of mouth. So they're literally taking it back to the old school marketing. And I do think that because so few people nowadays are focused on old school marketing, it's way more effective than it used to be, right? There's no competition. There's no modern fashion company that's doing old school marketing. So this kind of stuff, this experiential, or stunt marketing, let's call it, that's what Bottega is focusing on now. That much is obvious. Now, I, like, you were nice about it. I thought, are we just going to use, people's sacred spaces and historic monuments for advertisements? It's the same issue I had with the Tiffany & Co. Campaign where they used the Basquiat painting that no one had ever seen before, and then the first time they use it is in an ad. I'm like, okay, you guys need to chill. All right, we understand you've got sway. We understand you got pull as a luxury brand. Stop using people's cultures in that way. You know, if imagine you told your ancestors knew that your historic monument that kept them alive is used as an ad. So that's one thing. But what I did was I wasn't sure, because culturally it's different, I wasn't sure how actual Chinese people in China would adopt it. So I leaned on one of the foremost influential luxury bloggers in China, and they absolutely love it. Absolutely. Ooh. They think it's a slam dunk. They're like, this is the best campaign ever.
Okay. Now that framing changes perspectives a bit. I mean, if they're not upset about it, why are we upset on their behalf, I suppose?
Exactly. And I think that's really it. I think Bottega is really honing in on the local experiential or stunt marketing. So they're not going to replicate this. I saw, I think in Italy, they did a mural. Was it Italy or Norway? Somewhere like that. Somewhere in Europe, they did a mural and then they painted over their own mural with more messages as the days went by. Right. So people really liked that. And so they're really just trying something new. I don't hate them for it. But yeah, it comes off very bad. But I guess this is kind of a lesson to myself, to always check with the people they're actually trying to get, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we can go on and on about cultural insensitivity, but it's not our culture. If we're not from that culture, it even brings another point that you've rightly made. Do we even have a right to be very upset about it? The way I see things is that it looks like Bottega's going to go to different countries and use historical monuments in each country. And I suppose as long as the locals are fine with it and they're getting money and that historical artifact is getting attention and it's being preserved, then maybe why not? And maybe it brings another debate, as in, yes, these are historical monuments, but are they meant to do more than just sit there and be looked at? Can we put them to work? Can we get money out, make more money out of them? Right. Who knows? The commercialization. So interesting times, I suppose. Interesting times. Bottega Veneta, well played.
Well played, took a risk, but it really did work out. And now everyone is talking about them. So that is definitely well played on their part. Well, if you're enjoying this episode, then you should definitely follow us at Luxury News Weekly on Instagram. And of course, check out our socials in the description. And last but not least, leave us a review on iTunes. We would really appreciate it. It helps boost us and show us to more people. So feed that algorithm with a 5-star review. Thank you so much. All right, now let's get into this hot topic, okay? Why does Hermes hate NFTs? We'll tell you. Now, okay, Hermes, heritage company. They pride themselves for being the best, let's say, luxury goods makers in the world, leather in particular. Now, their pride and joy, the ultimate pride and joy, is the Birkin. All right? So, an artist called Mason Rothschild. He created Meta Birkins, 100 NFTs, and he listed them on, was it OpenSea?
Yes, OpenSea, for sure.
He listed them on OpenSea. Now, one even sold for, I think it was like $40,000. And they look, in my opinion, really nice. They're all fluffy. They have artworks on them. Some of them have like the Mona Lisa, or if you remember the banana with the duct tape, which was a hit 2 years ago. Yeah, so that's that. Now, so he lists these Birkin NFTs, Meta Birkins. Everyone's super excited. They think this is the best thing since sliced bread, as they would say, right? But the artist posts an open letter to say, I was sent a cease and desist letter from Hermes. And now everyone's thinking, you mean you didn't get permission from Hermes to do this in the first place? And then we thought, okay, that's that cease and desist letter. Did he cease or desist? Absolutely not. But OpenSea was not having it and kind of, you know, took it down. And on top of that, Hermes eventually actually sued him. They actually filed a lawsuit against him. What's your take, Elizabeth?
This, for me, is where you have luxury, art, technology, and the law colliding in a beautiful, combustible combination. The artist, this is brilliant for him because the value of his art is definitely going to go up. Because before this, I'd never heard of him. So I think in terms of being infamous, he's gone about it the right way. However, there are several things at play here, which I absolutely love. So let's have a tiny look at the law part of it. The trademark, copyright, etc., obviously belongs to Birkin. So for him to even use that name as the title of the collection of his art, first strike. Second strike was to actually use the handbags, the shape, the padlock, that particular padlock, etc. Having said that, I love the fact that he covers them in fluffy fur. I love the colors, etc., etc. However, I think this is a deliberate infringement on that particular, because without the Birkin name, this will not have got the prominence that it really has gotten now. Also, the price point. Now, this is what makes it interesting for me, because his price point is not that far off from what a real Birkin, a physical product, actually sells for. So again, touching on the kind of luxury space for Birkins. He created 100 unique NFTs. He also referenced and used art from Van Gogh's Starry Night, Leonardo da Vinci, Mona Lisa. So I am not surprised at all that Birkin decided to take very, very swift action. The thing about NFTs right now is that it's a very exciting space. And I remember asking a trademark and copyright lawyer if the law has been updated when it comes to the metaverse, because when you're filing a patent or a copyright or trademark, there are certain categories that you can tick in the box. So you can, it could be, I don't know, education, it could be physical, I don't know. You have to tick a number of boxes. I think I've gone through this before when I wrote my book. But here's the thing. I'm not sure there's a checkbox for the metaverse. Now, if you look at the name again, he's actually co-opted two really big names, Meta and Birkin. The Meta part, what if Facebook goes after him? Because they've actually trademarked that name. They've actually copyrighted Meta and they've changed their name to Meta. But it, when you're filing a trademark or whatever, if Facebook did not tick the NFT thing, and I suspect they probably have, or they would have had a clause or something, then he is well within his rights to actually use that name. So it's not a straight, it may not, well, let me put it this way. It may not be a slam dunk. This for me shows a couple of things. They need to update what, you know, they might not believe in NFTs now, but if they enter that space, and this is what the guy's trying to bring up, you know, from the conversation that I've seen around, he said that they are not selling in the NFT space right now. So there is a possibility that a judge might think, well, you sell physical goods, he sells digital goods. How do the two collide? So Hermes may need to show that where the two, you know, where the two collide. So they might have, the burden of proof might be on them. But if they can quickly enter into the NFT space, then that may strengthen their argument. Although I feel they have a very strong argument right now. But then again, I am not a trademark or a copyright lawyer. But I also love the irreverence and the kind of devil-may-care attitude that the artist has, because he's using it as an opportunity to put out statements to people, to get people to argue under his post. And he's loving the notoriety, because he said, well, my lawyers, they put it well when they said that the First Amendment gives me the right to make and sell art that depicts Birkin bags, just as it gave Andy Warhol the right to make and sell art depicting Campbell's soup cans. That's what he said. Now, that may sound crazy, but we don't know if Andy Warhol got permission from Campbell's soup. But then if I were Hermes, I would argue that Campbell's soup is a low, is not a low value, but it's not a luxury expensive item, right? It's a common, it's a common, you know, kind of soup. It's not exactly a handcrafted, luxury item that sells for well into six figures. So this for me is very interesting. And there are a number of luxury brands and artists right now and digital artists and technology people all watching this space, because we're thinking, how's the, you know, if there are no laws right now that govern NFT, the NFT creation or the NFT space, how can they judge? So to me, this is one of the most interesting stories to come out of 2022.
Yes. Now, you mentioned a couple of points that I want to kind of elaborate on, right? So, and like you said, he said, well, artists are always interpreting the world around them. It's my First Amendment right. I've never heard a good argument start with my First Amendment right is. Even though it's true, it's just, it's like starting an argument. Now, I don't mean to be offensive, but like just be offensive. Just say it, you know. But anyways, all right, so there's that. And I agree with him. But this is not that. This is not that. And I'll tell you what. Now, like you said, you're not a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer. But it just so happens that I used to run a room with, shout out to Sana Crown, who runs Fashion Africa Fashion Law Summit. And I was actually emceeing for that. And I was talking to basically the top fashion law experts in New York, in the world, actually, about topics just like this. The only difference was it wasn't in the NFT space, right? Yeah. So I have quite a bit of insight because of running, I wouldn't say I was running that room, but I was definitely contributing to that room on Clubhouse and doing the summit and literally talking to one of the founding members of fashion law in America, right? Okay, so this is an issue because maybe it's better to give an example. Do you remember Lil Nas, his devil shoes with Mischief?
Yes. Oh my goodness, of course. It caused such a commotion, yes.
So that pretty much set the precedent. So to give you some background, it's kind of a story within a story, but bear with me. This will all make sense. So, for those who don't know, in 2020 or 2021? Well, I'm not sure, but
2021.
Right, Lil Nas. He comes out with these shoes, and they were essentially a Nike silhouette. I think they were, I'm not exactly sure which type of Nikes they were, but they were called the Devil Shoes. They were black with red, and they had a drop of human blood on each one, and people were outraged. How, Nike, how could you do this? How could you sell, you know, devil-worshipping shoes, et cetera, et cetera? Nike was like, this is not us. And sued, well, and sent a cease and desist and said to Mischief. And Mischief is a creative agency, by the way. They do this kind of stuff all the time. Sent a cease and desist to Mischief. And then Mischief had to stop selling the actual shoe. And I don't know if they ended up getting sued, but they definitely settled the matter. And the court ruled in favor of Nike. And so Nike then put the hand of God down on every shoe customizer, okay? And that was dead in the water. Now, the entire creative side of the shoe customization kind of tribe, let's call it, on, because it's very much an online tribe, were outraged that because of Lil Nas, shoe customization is now like, there's a clear line you cannot cross with shoe customization. All that to say, the only reason Nike won was because with copyrights and trademarks, right? If someone is confused, if someone can confuse the creation with your company, you win that trademark battle. So in this particular case, people thought Hermes actually made these NFTs, and it's easily confusable that Hermes made these NFTs. So Hermes wins the trademark battle. With the case of Campbell Soup, no one thought Campbell made the painting, right? It's an artistic interpretation. This is a ripoff. You ripped the name. You ripped the silhouette. You ripped the iconic markers. And then you ripped other art. So, and you also did in a way that Hermes does always, every year, create a artist Birkin or an artist bag where they work with a particular famous artist and reinterpret their bag. They did the vegetables just in 2021. They worked with an artist who recreated Hermes Birkins as veggies and inanimate objects. So Hermes does this. So this is in my mind, it's a slam dunk for Hermes. Slam dunk. I don't think the artist has any legs on this one because they just did too many things.
Oh, a slight wrinkle, though. A slight wrinkle is the NFT space. Would anyone, yes, I understand about the name, silhouette, et cetera, everything. I completely agree with you. But one slight wrinkle, the NFT space.
I don't think it's a wrinkle at all because he's selling the image. It doesn't matter how you do that. You don't have to, because he's selling the image and it's confusable for the brand. And it's easy to confuse it for a product from Hermes. So it's technically a counterfeit, right? It's like not exactly a counterfeit. It's not a counterfeit, but it's a trademark infringement because, yeah.
It is, but I can argue that in the same vein but everyone knows that Hermes doesn't sell art. That's why I called it a wrinkle. I'm not saying it isn't an infringement. I think it's an open and shut case. However, I look for all the little wrinkles because you never know. Because with the Satan shoes, the judge just literally shut it down. He said, nope, can't sell. Nike went into action because we're talking physical product to physical product, right? My point is, this is physical product versus digital product. That's my only point. Not even sure it's that much of a point. However, we don't know. You see, this is what I keep saying. There's a gray area. There's a shady area around digital art and NFTs. Because I asked a lawyer and she said the problem is the law hasn't caught up with that world. And that's the only thing, you know, that's my point with that. Of course he did what they said he did.
Yeah. And if he didn't call it a Birkin, I guarantee you this wouldn't even be so much of an issue.
We wouldn't even be talking about it because there's no hook.
There's no hook. He could have used a silhouette and just not called it a Birkin, right? Like, a lot of artists do that with, you know, Disney. They just edit it a little bit. Koss is famous for taking Disney silhouettes, editing it a little bit. But he doesn't call it Mickey Mouse, Meta Mouse, right?
Meta like, Mouse.
Yeah. But, you know, we're going to keep up with this and we're going to see where this actually goes. So let's put this in the back burner and revisit this story because it is very important for creators and artists.
We are interrupting this episode to tell you a little bit about the people behind Luxury News Weekly. I'm your host, Simbo Wakatama, the founder and CEO of Volo Bespoke. We personalize jewelry storage for the jewelry you wear. Find me on Instagram or LinkedIn at Simba Wakatama.
I'm Elizabeth Solaru, founder and CEO of Luxury Business Emporium and Elizabeth's Cake Emporium. You can find me on LinkedIn as Elizabeth Solaru or on Instagram as Luxury Business Emporium.
Now, let's talk about the very tragic news we got very recently. And that is Thierry Mugler. He passed away at 73. And for those who don't know who he is a French fashion designer who was very, very influential, especially in the fragrance space, with one of his most famous fragrances being, what was the name of it? Angel?
Angel, yes. Angel, yes.
Angel. And not only that, he embodied the, I guess, power fashion, if that makes sense, for women. It was out there. It was really bold silhouettes with very graphic imagery and, you know, even using props, right? Like we have, for instance, a corset, which takes the shape of a motorcycle. With the rear mirrors and everything, right? So he's done work with Kim Kardashian. He did her red carpet dress where she looked like it was a wet nude dress with crystals hanging off of it like raindrops. He did the design for Cardi B for the Grammys where she looked like she was coming out of a clam, like a pearl. So he's done a lot of amazing stuff and really tapped into pop culture, even though he kind of quit fashion in the early 2000s, I believe.
Yes, but he came back for Beyoncé.
Of course, as anyone would do. So yeah, now I only learned about him recently. I did not know he had done all this stuff. So Elizabeth, you're going to have to, you know, kind of inform me about this man.
Yeah, love him, love him. He is a disruptor, fashion disruptor. I love his personal life because I always love to look behind the, you know, the artist, the facade that they present to the world. He was a bodybuilder. He was a ballet dancer and he lived life on the wild side, actually, because he actually had a physical fight. And again, I'm old enough to remember this. He had a physical fight with George Michael, and he was also involved in an accident that literally destroyed his face. I love him. A lot of models absolutely adored him. With Beyoncé, he came out of retirement to design her tour outfit because she saw this bodysuit thing that was all armor. It was all metal and gold that he had designed. She saw it at an exhibition in Paris. She was intrigued. And he came out of retirement and he said, yes. I love that he was a very kind person because when Cardi B first came on the scene and people didn't really take her seriously because she came from a reality TV, And he was actually the only designer to say yes to her and to say, yep, yeah, I'm going to give you that Cinderella fairy tale thing and I'm going to design something amazing for you. And she actually said that in the documentary. He is just one of those iconic designers. I love that he translated his art into perfume. Now, I remember wearing Angel. This, I'm talking about early 2000s, about 20 years ago. And we loved that perfume. In fact, the whole of London absolutely adored Angel. The bottle was iconic. I remember it being a blue bottle. I remember, you know, wearing it and, you know, feeling really, really powerful. He just was such an icon. And he absolutely loved the artistry around, how do you say the word? Dominatrix? Dominatrices? Is that the plural of it? So he borrowed from that to design a lot of the costumes. But anyway, I mentioned earlier that he smashed his face in an accident and he used that as an opportunity to actually transform his face because his nose was gone, his chin was gone. I think he just said, you know what, is an opportunity for me to reinvent myself. So that's why I think a lot of people kind of liked him because he had this ability to reinvent. So that's all I know about him. I just love his work, love what he represented, and love the fact that he actually gave lots of artists an opportunity to be themselves and express themselves differently to what people probably saw them as. So that's me.
Yeah, and I actually didn't notice that I was influenced by his design without even knowing who he was. And a lot of people kind of took inspiration from him, probably the biggest being Alexander McQueen.
Of course.
Yeah, so if you're a big Alexander McQueen fan, and I'm just mesmerized by the work of Alexander McQueen, we've spoken about him numerous times on Clubhouse and, you know, the exhibitions that they host in different museums or pop-ups are always just crazy. It's just the pinnacle of kind of haute couture meets just very creative and daring design, if that makes sense.
Yes, yes, absolutely, absolutely. I quite agree. And yes, that was one of the reasons he actually quit when he did, you know, in the early 2000s when he quit, because he said, look, you know, this space is not allowing me to be creative, is not allowing me to express myself because there's a lot about marketing, there's a lot about business, it's all about marketing. Because obviously, as an artist, you want to create, but then you've got to realize whatever you create has got to be sold. People have got to buy. And I suppose going into the perfume side of things was brilliant. It was a great move because we know that a lot of these brands make their money from perfumes and, you know, makeup, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought that was a really, really good move in preserving the brand and bringing in the much needed money for him.
Oh, yeah. His perfume outperformed over a lifetime every single perfume. The only contender is Chanel No. 5. That's it. That's the only one. Isn't that crazy?
I know, right? Well, may he rest in peace. He did brilliantly. I love when people live their life to the fullest. I love when they've used every ounce of their talent. And I suspect he may have had a lot more left in him, but, you know, at least from what he left behind, he left a legacy.
Definitely. And it will be felt. Now, you basically watch TikTok, right? Like,
oh, absolutely. I'm addicted. Yes.
Right. Me, not so much. My thing is Instagram. I am very, very addicted to Instagram and Instagram Reels. I actually looked at how much time I spent on Instagram on a daily basis, and I almost just deleted my entire account. Yeah, but so I'm sure you know the guy that goes. Let me do an impression of him, and you can guess who it is. Hey man, I like your car. What do you do for a living?
Oh yes, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, Daniel Mack.
Yes, yes. Yeah, he was one of the early stars of TikTok. Yes.
Yes, he was, and now he's just popular everywhere. Now, you know, he's always trying to spot the latest car. This car, I would put it as the car that Daniel Mack wished he spotted, okay? This is a $1.7 million Porsche, and it belonged to Robert Redford. Once upon a time, it belonged to Robert Redford. And for people who might not know who Robert Redford is, you know, because it's been a while. It's been a while for him since his heyday. He was in, what was it, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid?
Absolutely, yes, he was.
And yes. numerous titles, okay? But that was probably the most famous. Yeah, and so let me tell you about this Porsche, because not only, let me describe it to you. It is a 1964 904 GTS. It basically looks like a very retro sports Porsche with a green, it's half green on the top and then gray on the bottom. Very much a racing model. And this was popular in the 60s, the 1960s. Redford owned this car back in the 60s. Okay, and now it's going for auction, but it seems to be in pristine condition. And so it can fetch a whopping amount. I think 1.7 was kind of the ask, but we'll see what it actually goes for, because collectible cars, as we know, have been outperforming the stock market, significantly outperforming the stock market as an investment class. So this could end up being fetch a really good price because of its prestige, because of its ownership, right? Yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, I love the connection with Robert Redford. And I think obviously that alone in itself, the kind of provenance that this car has will definitely mean that there are collectors out there lining up. It's worth noting that the most notable success for Porsche in Formula One was in their final season in 1962. So they developed the Porsche 804 specifically for Formula One, as well as an advanced flat eight engine. So again, for those who are car lovers, this is definitely one to keep an eye on. And, you know, again, it's everything a luxury car should be. It's rare. It's got amazing provenance, carefully constructed. It's even got the color green. For me, it looks like a precursor to the Batmobile. That's, you know, every time I look at it, I'm thinking if the Batmobile was designed in the 60s as a retro car, this is what it would look like. So, yeah, Daniel Mack, wherever you are, I hope he gets to go to the auction.
Yeah, that would be really cool to see, actually, if he went to these auctions and, you know, asked the people buying the cars what they do for a living. They'll be like, no comments, no comments.
Exactly, no comment.
All right. Okay, now let's talk about leather, specifically mushroom leather, all right? So, because we haven't spoken about this on the podcast, we spoke about it in Clubhouse, let's bring you up to speed. So, Hermes is known for having the finest leathers in the world. And they gave a shot. They broke their record of using only genuine leather for one company. That company is called Mycoworks, and they make mushroom leather. It's out of mycelium. Now, this company gave Hermes a kind of test run leather that they then used in one of their bags. So it wasn't a completely vegan bag, but the body, the shell of the bag, was mushroom leather, and it was tanned to look like real leather. And it seemed to have gone very well because they just raised $125 million to meet demand and up production. All right. And I believe Hermes actually invested in them very early. And now this is a Series C funding. So they are definitely going to expand. And I would not be surprised if you start to see their leather be the standard of quality for a lot of luxury goods companies, because if it passes Hermes's test, then it's good enough pretty much everybody. So that's a little bit of the background there. Elizabeth, you know, you are a scientist. This is right up your alley.
Oh, absolutely. Again, this is a mushroom leather. As we've said, they have a technology in place to grow this leather from a special type of mushroom. And then by using a special biotechnology and tanning process, they can get this to almost, well, to, I would say, almost or even, you know, feel and look like real leather. When it comes to leather goods or leather, the tanning process is where the value is added. So what do I mean by that? One of the reasons why Italian leather is the best is because they use vegetable tanning, and it's a process that lasts up to 8 weeks. With ordinary leather, you can use chemical tanning or some other sort of tanning process. It speeds up the process, but you don't quite get the nice, soft, supple leather that Italian leather is renowned for. So there's a reason I mentioned this, because it's one thing to say, yep, it's vegan leather, or it's, mycelium leather, it's completely animal free, blah, blah, blah. But we also need to understand that at some point, the leather's going to be treated with color. And sometimes, because of the fact that the leather wasn't actually gotten from an animal, they may need to use certain chemicals that are actually quite bad for the environment. So yes, we've got sustainable leather on one hand, but we need to also look at the other side when it comes to using colors, etc., etc. This company partnered with Hermes in 2021, as we spoke about it earlier, but now they've actually managed to partner with other major brands. In fact, their CEO said, if you've heard of the company, the likelihood is we are partnering with them. So it looks like they're at the forefront of their alternative leather. So they're at the forefront. They've also said another statement, which, you know, kind of like, you know, was of interest to me. And they said that, yes, for now, they are dealing in the luxury side of things, but they aim to go into mass production soon. And I suppose that is being driven by the funding that they are receiving, because so far they probably received around $300 or so million in addition to this later. So let's watch this space. So it'll be interesting to see if this company takes over and grabs a larger share of the market, because if they keep going and they're very successful at growing leather, many more customers are going to turn into not wanting animal leather. So there you have it.
Yes. And, you know, you did mention the tanning process. I think that's very important for people to understand. You know, there's basically two types of tanning that you usually do, and that's where all the harsh chemicals are used. It's quite a process. So you've got vegetable tan or chrome tan. And chrome tan is really toxic. It's really toxic because you're speeding up the skin taking in the dyes, right? And then vegetable tan, it's completely, the dyes are from vegetables, right? Takes longer, more expensive, more labor, better result. But you're still more limited in colors.
Exactly.
Right. Now, my engineering brain immediately goes to performance. we don't use leather because we like killing cows. You know? We use leather because it is, as a material, a high-performance material. If you want to make a bag that doesn't break, you use leather. If you want to make it water-resistant, you use leather. If you want to make it, strong, stretchy, or not stretchy, or breathable, or this, you know, you use organic materials. Now, of course, mushroom is an organic material, but my initial take when Hermes used the leather was, this is not strong enough. And for sure, that's why they made all the straps 100% leather. They made all the seams and joints metal or 100% leather, because clearly the material doesn't have the endurance yet. And also sewing it, the construction, right? I feel like it's gonna be not as high performance as leather, and that would imagine if Hermes sells you a bag that just breaks, right?
Ooh, disaster.
Yeah, because you want it to be vegan. What's worse, buying a vegan bag that breaks, or just not buying the bag at all, right? But they make it out of leather.
But having said that, though, again, let's look at it from a scientific point of view. They're using particular strains. I'm assuming anyway that they're using particular strains of mushroom to grow the leather. There might be a possibility of certain genetic manipulations. So to make sure that the mushroom, again, this is what I would do. I'm just talking about if I were thinking about this. Mm-hmm. I would use different variations of mushroom. Obviously, they've done that. They produced the initial mushroom. And they've tested it commercially. I will also keep going back to the drawing board, because it's not just animal leather. I think because it's grown, you have that leeway to keep going back and testing genetic. You know, that's why they would hire scientists to try and genetically manipulate. So you never know. One day they might be able to produce a leather that is even more durable than animal leather, so who knows?
Probably, but you know, we already have synthetic leather, pleather. It sucks. It really sucks. It's not durable. It's not that. It cracks very easily on the top surface. The mushroom thing, it's all in the fibers. It's all in the fibers. Skin is strong, especially when you treat it, because of the way the cells grow and everything. But when you have to basically make pulp out of mushrooms, right? Then the fibers are not as strong. The bonds between the fibers are not as strong. It's a different story, but they can definitely do it. And there's also pineapple leather. There's cactus leather. There's all kinds of leathers that I feel like they're going to end up making. So if you want the strong, you do this. If you want the soft, you do that. I think there's plenty of room for growth in this space, and we will keep up to date with it.
Absolutely.
Well, this has been an interesting episode. Thank you for listening this far. If you like what you heard, give us a review. Give us a review. We would really appreciate your support. And as always, tune in to Luxury News Weekly every single week.